Hey there, it's Kona Gallagher, host of And Then They Were Gone and Day by Day True Crime Stories, and I'm here to bring you an amazing opportunity to win some incredible prizes, all for a good cause. Join the Texas Advocacy Project's The Big Game Football Squares Raffle on February 9th, 2025, and help support survivors of power-based abuse. For every $100 donation, you secure a square and a chance to win amazing prizes. You can choose from two exciting grids. The Hawaiian Paradise Grid offers a grand prize of a seven-night stay for two at a luxury resort in Oahu or the Big Island. Or play the Beachfront Mexico Grid for a chance to win a four-night, all-inclusive stay for two at a five-star Marival Luxury Resort in Banderas Bay or Nuevo Nayarit, Mexico. Your contributions help survivors understand their rights, navigate the justice system, and secure emergency protective orders. To participate, visit TexasAdvocacyProject.org and select your grid today. Don't miss out. Tune in to the Texas Advocacy Project's Facebook page on February 9th, 2025, during the game for live updates on winners. Prizes are awarded at the end of each quarter, with the grand prize at the game's conclusion. So score big for a cause. Visit TexasAdvocacyProject.org to learn more.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
When Corey Bigsby reported his four-year-old son Cody missing on January 31st, 2022, his story didn't seem to add up. According to him, that morning he put Cody to bed around 1 a.m. and checked in on him at 2, but when he woke up around 8:30 a.m., he found his son's bed empty. Cody Bigsby was missing, along with his Spider-Man flip-flops. Hampton, Virginia police took Cody's father, Corey, down to the station for questioning and eventually arrested him on charges of child neglect. Corey remained in jail for months and went through several competency and bond hearings. On June 5th, 2023, a grand jury indicted Corey for the murder of his son, Cody Bigsby. His trial began on March 4th, 2024. This week, we are bringing you the trial of Corey Bigsby. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Cody Bigsby. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode, and he is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Now, this week is, of course, a little bit different because it is a follow-up to a case that we have covered before on this show. So you do know, you know, about the circumstances
of
this. Yes,
the basics of the case, yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know anything about the updates.
This is the third full episode that we've devoted to Cody Bigsby. We also featured him in one of our update episodes as well. But each episode that we do on this story is more difficult than the last. This one is especially hard because I was able to read Corey's written jailhouse confessions, which are incredibly graphic. The testimony given by witnesses is also extremely difficult to hear, especially the testimony of Cody's older brother, who is now only 7 years old. If you haven't listened to our other two episodes on Cody's story, I've actually re-released them, so you can find them right below this episode in your podcast app. Our original episode talks about Cody's family background, his father's story of his disappearance, and Corey's initial charges. The update episode, which we recorded this past summer, covers Corey's multiple competency hearings, his bail hearings, and eventual murder indictment. So now, let's get into the trial of Corey Bigsby. The case against Corey Bigsby is relatively simple. Police simply did not believe his initial story of waking up to find that his four-year-old son was mysteriously missing. He ended up being charged with several counts of child neglect after he admitted to leaving his four children home alone for several hours when he went to go buy a car a few months back. These charges allowed Corey to be kept in jail while police worked to find out what happened to Cody. Over the course of the investigation, police began to believe that Cody died long before January 31st, 2022, when Corey reported him missing. This belief was based partially on interviews with Cody's older brother, who was about five at the time. While he was incarcerated, Corey Bigsby wrote several confessions in which he admitted that Cody was dead and that he had buried his body. These confessions became the main piece of evidence against Corey. What his jury is tasked with now is deciding if these confessions are true, or if, as Corey's attorney, Amina Matheny Willard, stated last year, quote, he lost his son and then he lost his mind, end quote.
Right, because it isn't, there were a lot of different versions that he put together in his confessions, right?
Yeah, and we're going to really dig into that because obviously that's a big part of the trial.
Yeah.
But yes, there are four written confessions in total. Three written by Corey himself, and the first one, which was written by a corrections officer and dictated to him by Corey.
Right.
So yeah, four different confessions, but a lot of discrepancies in each one.
Right. Yeah. And if I remember correctly, each one gets more and more detailed and graphic, right? Or does it?
It jumps back and forth a little bit.
But the details change.
Yes.
Okay.
But some remain the same throughout each one.
Right.
Yeah. So it's really tough. And of course, Cody Bigsby's body has not been found. There has been no trace of him found since the investigation began on January 31st, 2022, which, of course, was first a missing child investigation and then did become a homicide investigation. Corey Bigsby had his first competency hearing in December 2022, nearly a year after his initial arrest. In that hearing, two doctors testified and each had a different opinion as to Corey's competency. This led the judge to call for another hearing in March 2023. In that hearing, the judge ordered Corey Bigsby to undergo restoration services at Eastern State Hospital. Restoration services are given to defendants who may not currently be competent to stand trial, but could potentially be with additional mental health care. The idea that the defense has been going with, you know, from the beginning that Corey made these confessions up, the idea doesn't come out of nowhere. I mean, because he does have demonstrated mental health issues.
Sure, but then it makes you question, are there parts of this confession that are true?
Right. Corey was back in court in June 2023, and in that hearing, he was deemed fit to stand trial, so after the restoration services. That was also when the murder indictment was announced. I believe it was actually two separate hearings, you know, but the same week. On June 21st, Corey was granted a bond hearing on all of the charges against him, which by this point totaled 30 felonies and two misdemeanors.
How were there so many?
It was several charges of child neglect. So most of the felonies were related to that. And there were four children. So each child.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And each charge, it added up quickly. Yeah. Much to the public and the Commonwealth's surprise, Corey Bigsby was granted bond and was released from jail.
Okay. That's wild. I'm assuming and hoping that he doesn't have contact with his other kids.
Well, yeah, that's a
condition of the release.
Yes, it is. And so I did go off onto a little kind of sidebar about this, because that was my first reaction. Like, how the hell did this guy get out on bond, you know? So yes, the conditions of his bail stated that Corey was to undergo GPS monitoring, have a curfew of 8 p.m. to 6 a.m., to live with a family member, and have no contact with his children.
Okay.
The court further ordered that he was only to leave the house to travel to court for medical appointments or to meet with his attorneys. Now, again, it's still, even with those stipulations, it still, to me, was surprising that he was granted bail.
For sure, yeah.
The Commonwealth of Virginia was too, so they actually appealed the decision. Now, the Court of Appeals decision was released on February 5th, 2024, and I was able to get my hands on it. So it's a 7-page document. I'm not going to get into like every single point of the appeal, but I will upload the document to our blog if you would like to read it yourself. Reading over the document, I can understand why the judge not only granted bail the first time, the initial judge, but why the Court of Appeals upheld that judge's decision. And of course, quick disclaimer, we have had a lot of new listeners lately. I am just a realtor, but this is my general understanding. Basically, there are 8 criteria to consider when deciding whether or not to grant bail. They are the nature and circumstances of the offense, whether a firearm was used, the weight of the evidence, the history of the accused, including family ties, employment, education, medical, mental health, or substance abuse treatment, ties to the community, record of convictions, whether or not they are a flight risk, and whether or not the person is likely to obstruct or attempt to obstruct justice, or if they're likely to threaten, intimidate, or injure potential witnesses, family members, etc. The Commonwealth mainly wanted Corey to be remanded based on the severity of his alleged crimes, the potential of him being a flight risk, and the possibility that if released, he could obstruct justice by further hiding Cody's body.
Right. I mean, he's already obstructing justice.
By hiding the body in the first place.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, and that is one of the charges that he is charged with, which is concealment of a body.
And did he plead guilty?
No.
So
he's pleaded not guilty to everything.
So he, whoa. Okay. Back up here a second. So he wrote out these multiple confessions and now he's pleading not guilty?
Correct.
Saying that his confessions were what? Not true because he was
coerced. He was, you know, under a mental strain, you know, he was tortured, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
Now, the defense stated that Corey has never missed a court date. I mean, granted, he was incarcerated for all of his court dates, but, yeah. You know, it's still true. And they had 2 family members testify that they would bring Corey to his future court dates. He also has no prior criminal record and was honorably discharged from the U.S. Army. He owns a home in Hampton. You know, ties to the community, but could also stay with another family member if the court wanted. His children were also, by the time of this hearing, currently living out of state, so he had no access to them. There were also no allegations that a firearm had been used in any of the charged offenses. The Commonwealth honestly didn't have a lot to offer in rebuttal of these points. They claimed that Corey was a flight risk based on the fact that he was apparently reported as absent without leave in the Army, but he was never convicted of that while in the Army. And furthermore, the Commonwealth didn't present evidence related to this. This was just something they said as like, you know, as part of their arguments. They provided no documentation or any proof that that actually happened.
It sounds to me like the Commonwealth was caught off guard by the ruling.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's definitely potentially possible. You know, they also reiterated during the initial hearing that releasing Corey would potentially allow him to destroy evidence and allow him to interfere with the investigation by, quote, continuing to hide the body, right. End quote. So, yeah, so basically they're contention was that he's hidden Cody's body, and now if he's given time, he could hide it better or further tamper with it in a way that would hurt the chances of police recovering him.
Right.
But basically what it came down to is that of the 8 criteria, Corey had the majority of them working in his favor. The chance of him obstructing justice is compelling to me, and I mean, that was my biggest one. But that should be mitigated by the GPS monitor, the ankle monitor.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in theory, but them not knowing where his body is, who's to say that he's not staying at in the residence or where his body is hidden.
I mean, you're right. That's a good point. If for whatever reason he had hidden Cody's body in or around, I believe it was his sister's house where he was staying, then yeah, he had basically unfettered access
right
to him for months.
Right.
In all appearances, he would be perfectly following the rules of his bond.
Right.
So, I mean, I feel like that's a relative, you know, long shot, but not an impossibility, certainly. But apparently, again, it wasn't a big enough of a possibility for the original judge or the Court of Appeals to not give Corey Bigsby bond. So he has been out since last summer. We are recording this right after the trial ends, which is why this is not a two-parter. It's just going to be a long-ass single episode because we are covering the entire trial up to and including the verdict. Jury selection for Corey Bigsby's trial began on Monday, March 4th, and lasted 3 days. 69 potential jurors were called, which was whittled down to 26 before getting the final 14-person jury, which was 12 regular juries and 2 alternates. The selection process itself was contentious, with lead defense attorney Curtis Brown asking Judge James Hawks to recuse himself on day 2.
Why?
Well, one potential juror during, you know, voir dire said that he would need evidence of a body and an autopsy in order to convict somebody of murder, basically. The Commonwealth unsurprisingly moved to strike this juror as sure. They did not have either of those things.
Right.
And the judge allowed them to strike the juror. Brown got upset and asked that the judge recuse himself because it seemed as though he was siding with the prosecution.
But I mean, both sides can dismiss a juror for cause.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a certain number and it depends on the jurisdiction, but like they can dismiss a juror for no reason whatsoever. No known reason.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know about that. The judge declined to recuse himself. Brown also complained that the Commonwealth was dismissing jurors based on race and argued before the judge to get more black jurors on the panel. And this is a big one because, you know, there have been Supreme Court cases on this, multiple ones. You cannot dismiss jurors based solely on race.
Oh, 100%.
The Supreme Court has found that and upheld that.
Yeah, to me, this sounds like the defense is already setting up potential appeals.
Oh, for sure. So when asked why Brown wanted more black jurors on the panel, he said, quote, black folks are more sympathetic, end quote.
Okay.
Which,
no empirical
there are a
evidence.
Lot of other reasons to want black jurors on a jury when your defendant is a black male, but like...
I mean, let's just lead off with that one. How about, like, he wants a jury of his peers?
Yeah, like, that's really it.
Leave it at that.
Just leave it at that. The final jury ended up consisting of 10 women, 4 men, and of the 14 jurors, 9 are white, 4 are black, and 1 is Hispanic. After jury selection was completed, each side read their list of potential witnesses. These lists are often much larger than the number of people who actually end up testifying. The defense named over 25 people, but did not reveal whether or not Corey Bigsby would take the stand in his own defense. The Commonwealth named 20 people, including several law enforcement officers, Cody's mother, and Cody's older brother, who is now 7. The Commonwealth of Virginia came out swinging and dropped a bombshell in their opening arguments. Not only did they claim that evidence would show that Cody had been dead for months before being reported missing, which we did know from the indictment, but Commonwealth attorney Dylan Arnold called Corey Bigsby a predator, saying, quote, after Corey realized what he had done and after, he put his body in bed with his older brother, end quote.
What?
Yeah.
Oof. I have a feeling that's probably going to come from his son's testimony.
Yeah.
That's going to be really hard to read through.
It is. I think this whole thing is going to be one of those situations where I wrote all this and was fine, but when it comes time to actually talk about it, it will not go well. So we'll just see. Corey's other attorney, Kenneth Singleton, gave their opening arguments in which he, of course, refuted the Commonwealth's assertion that Corey killed his son. He claimed that Cody actually woke up in the middle of the night and wanted to go outside and play in the snow. Corey told him to go back to bed, but when Corey woke up the next morning, the four-year-old was gone. After he couldn't find him, he frantically called 911.
So now we're going back to his original assertion that he woke up and he was gone, but he added a potential reason for him to be going.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of him playing in this, of Cody going to play in the snow, is not one that I've heard before. I'm not saying that, you know, it's new information necessarily, but yeah, that it was definitely new to me.
Yeah.
After opening arguments, the prosecution called their first witness, Dina Abdul Karim, Cody's mother. Dina has been somewhat of a mysterious figure in this entire story. She initially wasn't named in the press, and no one knew exactly what the custody situation was. We did find out that all four of the children who lived with Corey were from that relationship, and that he, at the time of Cody's disappearance, had primary custody of them. During her testimony, we found out some more details about their arrangement. The pair was together for 4 years, during which time they had four sons. Cody was the second, and the two youngest were twins who were under 2 years old when Cody was reported missing. Dina ended her relationship with Corey in 2019 and moved to Washington, D.C., about 170 miles away from Corey's Hampton, Virginia home.
Do we have any, or do we know any reason why they split?
No, I don't know anything about that.
Allegations of abuse or anything like that?
Yeah, nothing that came up, no.
Okay.
It sounds like in 2019, when she ended the relationship, she did take the kids.
Oh, okay.
But in 2020, Dina was hospitalized with an unspecified illness. At that point, she decided to hand over custody of all the boys to Corey, but wanted to co-parent. She just, you know, I don't know what the illness was, but whatever it was, she just felt like she could not properly handle four small children.
Right.
On November 20th, 2020, she met Corey halfway between DC and Hampton to exchange the kids. And that was the last time she ever saw Cody. According to Dina, Corey did not honor their co-parenting agreement. And I just want to step in here really quick with a sidebar. Corey and Dina were never married, which means that they don't legally need to have a custody order in place. So typically, you know, if you are married, you have kids as part of the divorce, there's also a custody arrangement done in the court system. When you're not married, you don't have to do any of that.
It's a smart idea.
To do it. Yeah, yes, for sure. Because this is exactly the type of thing that could happen. But a lot of couples in this situation just have informal custody agreements. And that basically sounds like what was going on with Corey and Dina at this time. So she, you know, took the kids. She got sick. Corey took the kids. But Dina's like, listen, I'm not like giving you the kids. I still want to see them. Corey apparently agreed, but did not hold up his end of the bargain. So back to Dina's allegations, she said that Corey refused to give her his address and was often unreachable, which is why she didn't see her kids after dropping them off with him in late 2020. In April 2021, Dina received a disturbing email from Corey in which he alleged that Cody was fondling his twin brothers. The email partially read, quote, Cody is still doing the same stuff. He needs to come back to you. I do not want to seriously hurt him to protect my babies, end quote.
Doing the same stuff, indicating that he had done this before?
Yeah, I guess indicating that this had been an ongoing problem with Cody. Now, he also went on to say that Cody needed to see a psychiatrist, which, I mean, maybe he did. But Dina says she didn't believe the allegations that Corey was making in the email. But regardless, I want to make it absolutely clear that at the time this email was written, Cody had just turned 3 and his brothers were maybe a year old. Even if these allegations are true, Cody is a toddler. Like, this is a behavioral issue. He's not a predator.
Right. Did either of the attorneys ask if this had been an ongoing problem with Cody?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
That's why the veracity of Corey's accusations doesn't really matter. Either it was true and Cody did perhaps need to see some sort of therapist, or Corey was making it up, in which case he's the one who needs psychiatric help. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if this was before or after that email, but Dina states that she was able to speak with Cody on the phone in April 2021, but was unable to speak with him after that. Curtis Brown, Corey Bigsby's defense attorney, attacked Dina as a mother, basically saying that she should have seen her kids more. He also asked if she sent clothing or money for her children during the time that they were with Corey, to which she replied that she sent $150, and she sent that because that's what Corey had asked her to send. Brown also asked why she didn't contact any of Corey's family for help when she couldn't get in touch with him for visitation. She replied that her relationship with his family was not cordial and that she didn't have any of their contact information. In a move that I find pretty confounding, Brown also showed Dina a photo of Cody that was taken during the time in which Corey had him. And this is one of the photos that has been circulating around of Cody standing in front of a refrigerator. In tears, Dina replied, quote, "Yes, he looks sad. I'm used to seeing him joyful, smiling. He looks frightened," end quote. And that particular bit of testimony stood out to me because in the course of researching this case over the last couple of years, I've been on Facebook, Web Sleuths, and many other online forums in which people have been discussing Cody's disappearance. Dina's characterization of Cody in that photo is one that I have seen other people say time and time again over the last 2 years. The younger photos of Cody show a beautiful, happy little boy, and the more recent ones of him show a child who does look sad and frightened. On Wednesday, March 6th, the jury was also shown body cam footage from the officers who first responded to the Bigsby home after Corey reported Cody missing. Unfortunately, although the judge in this trial did allow news outlets to film inside of the courtroom, they were not permitted to broadcast sound, so we don't have audio from the body cams. An officer did testify to some information that I didn't know about, however. Corey claimed to him that the sliding glass door in the back of their home didn't lock and that he'd reported it to maintenance several times before Cody's disappearance. And this was apparently given as his explanation as to how Cody could have left the house in the middle of the night. However, the prosecution also called a property manager for Buckrow Point Apartments to the stand, who testified that in the weeks after Cody's disappearance, she escorted a CPS worker who inspected the unit as part of their investigation. Because remember, at the time, Corey was only facing the child neglect charges.
Right.
So it makes sense that CPS was doing an investigation. So they cleared the clutter that was blocking the back door, which in and of itself, clutter blocking the back door, not to say that that was
difficult
there that night, but
it, sure,
indeed. But they tried the lock and the property manager testified that it was in perfect working order. She also said that she was not aware of any complaints that Bigsby had made about the door, but under cross-examination admitted that there were circumstances in which she wouldn't be aware of every resident's complaint.
Sure, but complaint or not, the door locked.
Yeah, and the defense offered no evidence that the door had been repaired, that the apartment complex had come and fixed it in the time in between Cody's reported disappearance and this investigation, however many weeks later.
Right. I'd be curious to know what the CPS worker stated in his or her report.
Yeah, well, that's something we may find out later.
Okay.
But not in this trial. Thursday, day four of the trial, had to have been the most difficult for courtroom spectators. It was the day that Cody's older brother, who is now 7, testified. We covered the judge's decision on this in our update episode, but Basically, although Cody's brother was on site for his testimony, he was permitted to testify in an adjoining room via live video. In his testimony, he described how their father generally treated Cody, saying that Corey would often punish his little brother and that, quote, he would spank him. He also said that he didn't like living with his father because he told lies about Cody. During his two-hour-long testimony.
Jesus, that's really long.
I mean, for an adult. Yeah. People who are inside of the courtroom said that, like, he was definitely, you know, starting to lose focus and was having a difficult time with this, as you can imagine. So during his testimony, the brother said that Cody, whom he nicknamed Coco, was his best friend. He then went on to recount a day in which he wasn't able to wake Cody up. And I think this goes back to the opening statement in which the prosecutor alleged that after his death, Corey placed Cody in his brother's bed. Cody's brother says that he shook him, but that Cody didn't respond. He also testified that Cody's face was red, dry, and bruised. He went to tell his father that something was wrong with his brother, but Corey said that nothing was wrong with Cody. The prosecution asked him if he believed his father, to which he responded, quote, no, because he looked dead, end quote. The defense's cross-examination aimed to discredit the boy and show that his testimony was basically a story he had made up. For instance, they asked if Corey had ever spanked him, to which he said yes, contradicting his earlier testimony in which he said that Cody was the only one who was ever spanked. He was also asked if he told anyone else the story of not being able to wake Cody up. He initially said no, but then changed his answer to yes. He also seemed confused about time and when certain events occurred.
Because he was five when this happened.
If even. I mean, I think he might have even been four at the time or just five. I don't know his birth date, but he was so little and kids don't have a good sense of time. After the emotional testimony in which the boy cried at times, along with some of the courtroom spectators, the prosecution called a CPS worker to the stand. Her testimony mainly lined up with Cody's brother's, meaning that she corroborated his account of finding Cody unresponsive because he had previously also told her that story. It should also be said that, you know, again, not that you can judge from somebody's body language all the time, but Corey Bigsby during this testimony remained stoic and was said to have even yawned a couple times. On Friday, we got to the crux of the Commonwealth's case, the confessions. Corrections officers from Hampton Roads Regional Jail testified about the various confessions that Corey had made while incarcerated. The first officer, Jamal Massey, testified that on August 4th, 2022, Corey asked him to write down the following. Quote, I found my son unresponsive, tried CPR, could not revive him, tried several times, I begged God to save him, end quote. Corey then said that he walked outside to talk to God again and then went back inside to check on Cody to see if he had miraculously started breathing. When it was clear that he had not, he, quote, put trash bag, put in can, sat for 3 days, end quote. He then gave an address in Maryland and said that he buried Cody and described where to find the gravesite. And we have this dictated statement, which Corey then asked to sign, and you can see it on her blog. The officer became visibly emotional during his testimony and said that Corey was, quote, very adamant about what he was saying. He did not hesitate, end quote. Another CO, Lieutenant Kate Evans, testified that on that same day, she gave Corey a pen and paper, and he wrote another confession. In this one, he claims that on January 30th, 2022, he went out to get some items out of his car to do laundry, and when he returned, he, quote, found my son Cody Josiah Bigsby laying at the bottom of the steps unresponsive. He must have fallen, end quote. He goes on to give a similar story about administering CPR several times and praying. He also repeated the story about putting his son in a trash bag and driving him to the same street in Maryland. However, in this version, the trip took place around 3:30 a.m. on January 31st, just hours before he reported Cody missing. He says that he initially put Cody into a trash bin, but then removed him and put him in a hole that he had dug beside a tree. He described the burial site, saying that Cody had a cowboy's rug under him, Beats headphones in his ears, and that there was tape around his ankles and wrists. Quote, "I then ate and placed his bike in some trash after I ate at the scene," end quote.
I think that we've gone over that in the previous update, correct?
Yeah, we did talk about this because excerpts of these confessions did come out with the indictment. So we did know about this, especially because there were also hearings in which the defense wanted to have them thrown out, basically.
Yeah, I'm sure I brought this up the last time, but his ankles and wrists being taped.
Yeah, there's no need to do that if he's already dead.
Right.
I mean, that struck me then. It strikes me now. It's such an interesting detail. It doesn't show up in any of the other confessions. You know, we've gone through two of them so far, both done on the same day, one that was dictated to a correctional officer and one that was written by Corey himself. And only in the second one does he talk about the tape. This is also the only one in which he describes a rug and the headphones that he says are buried with Cody.
Right. It also implicates him leaving his other children.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's not what the charges stem from. So the charges stem from an incident in December of 2021 in which he went to Norfolk to go and buy a car and left his children home alone for several hours.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it does sound as though leaving his children alone was something that he did fairly regularly. Ivana Cotto took the stand next. She is now a former corrections officer, and if this is why, I can't blame her. As she detailed the next letter, people in the courtroom began to cry. Now, this confession is written in crayon and was in a notebook that Corey was in possession of. Inmates are allowed to have crayons in their cells, but not pens or pencils. And I will say real quick that one of the arguments that the defense made as to why this particular confession shouldn't be allowed is because it was in a notebook that had like doodles and scribbles and like was all written in crayon, and saying that, you know, that shows that he wasn't in his sound mind when he wrote this confession. But again, you know, a jail official was like, yeah, that it's written in crayon because that's what they're allowed to have.
Right. Because it's hard to make a shank or out of a crayon.
Exactly.
Not impossible, but
right,
harder.
But it doesn't show that he's got like some childlike, you know,
right,
mentality or whatever the defense was trying to prove. So anyway, Cotto testified that on Christmas Day 2022, Corey Bigsby placed this paper on his tray slot. Now, in this version of his confession dated November 5th, 2022, Corey details a much more violent death at his hands. Now, as I was writing this, because again, we knew a little bit about this from the previous hearings, but this is the first time that I was able to actually see the handwritten entire confession, and it's awful. I mean, it made me physically ill to read. So I struggled with how much detail to go into. And in the end, I decided that I am going to leave some parts out because I think you can get the point without them. And again, you know, all of this is available. If you want to read the entire thing for yourself, you will be able to. In this letter, Corey says that on June 18th, 2021, he beat his son, who was 3 at the time, with his fists. He said that Cody then went into cardiac arrest. He then repeats the story about trying to give him CPR and praying to God to bring Cody back. After trying to revive him in the bathtub, he laid him in bed while he charged up a flashlight and went to a gas station to get gas and buy snacks. In this version, Corey changes a few details about transporting Cody's body. In this one, he says he put him in a fridge and then in a bag, but he does name the same location in Maryland as the burial site. He goes on to say that he went to King's Dominion, a nearby amusement park, the next day. And then afterwards, he, quote, went to the hospital and I dumped my clothes from the crime in the trash and burned them, end quote. And the reason why I quoted that line is because I'm not exactly clear as to the meaning of it. I don't know if this is two separate events, that he went to the hospital and then in a separate event, he threw his clothes from the crime in the trash and burned them, or if he went to a hospital
and like threw his, set a dumpster on fire?
Yeah, I don't know. So I just wanted to say exactly what he said instead of like trying to interpret that on my own. He also says that he went back to where Cody was buried and tampered with the body in order to cover up scars from previous beatings. Again, I've left off a few of the more sickening details, but you can read these letters in his own writing if you'd like. Though his third confession was the most heartbreaking and graphic, it wasn't Corey Bigsby's last. On January 8th, 2023, nearly a year after he reported his son missing, Corey wrote a fourth confession. In this one, he says that on January 31st, 2021, he attempted to perform CPR on Cody. Now, Cody was, of course, reported missing the following year, January 31st, 2022. This could have been just a simple mistake, or it could show that Corey's grasp on reality isn't completely there. The letter gives the same story of praying to God and then burying Cody in Maryland. It ends with, quote, "Then I drove home and prayed to Jesus to save Cody, and I failed him, so I am becoming tired of torture. So now I am confessing because my family and the police is conducting these crimes, and I cannot take it anymore," end quote.
Aside from them being horrible to listen to, why in the third one was he in a bathtub?
He said that he put Cody in the bathtub and put water on him in an attempt to revive him.
So given that he hasn't exactly been very forthright with a lot of the details, I'm wondering if possible drowning was involved. I mean, obviously, we won't know until we either find Cody or possibly never know.
Right.
At this point. So did the police look in that area?
Yes.
In Maryland?
They have done searches because, like I said, he gave them very specific directions.
Right.
To a site, including a building number, and described, like, you know, it's by a tree, it's, you know, near this tree line. But police have not been able to find anything. Out of the four confessions, the prosecution seems to be hanging their hat on the one from November 5th, 2022, in which Corey Bigsby admits to causing the death of Cody Bigsby on June 18th, 2021. In the murder indictment, Corey is accused of killing his son on or about June 18, 2021. After Ivana Cotto's testimony, the Commonwealth called Darren Spencer, a digital data analyst with the FBI, to the stand. He testified that, quote, "there were no original pictures of Cody," end quote, past June and July 2021 on Corey Bigsby's phone. There were, however, photos of Corey's other children. The prosecution wrapped up their case around 4 p.m. on Friday after calling 14 witnesses. The defense was slated to present their case beginning on Monday, March 11th. On Monday morning, the defense played the 911 call that Corey Bigsby made on January 31st, 2022, in which he reported Cody missing. The defense's goal here is to reiterate Corey's original story, that he woke up, saw Cody was missing, frantically searched for him, and then called the police. Their contention is that Corey was basically tortured while in custody and that his confessions were not based in fact. This claim is partially bolstered by the fact that police were found to have violated Corey Bigsby's constitutional rights during his initial interrogation, which we go into in depth in our original episode on Cody. And Corey does also mention torture and crimes perpetrated by police in his final confession letter. That's the thing, like, that I found so difficult about this case. And you can really hear it again in that first episode. because as somebody who is completely uninvolved and just started looking into it, his story made zero sense to me. However, the way police interrogated him was not okay.
Right.
And, you know, a court found that they violated his constitutional rights. And guilty or not, I don't think police should go around violating constitutional rights.
No, for sure.
And it absolutely, one, is just a wrong thing to do in general, but two, does cast doubt on a potential case, because when the defense claims, like, listen, he wrote these confessions, but they were coerced. He, you know, it was a product of him being like tortured by police. It has more weight to it than it would otherwise, because the police have demonstrated that they are willing to cross the line with him.
Right.
I still believe that his story doesn't make sense, but the police really created a situation in which the defense could possibly prove reasonable doubt based mainly on their behavior.
Yeah. It's super important for police to be able to remove themselves emotionally from situations like this. I don't know if this was emotionally driven or what the impetus was for the cops to keep him longer than he was supposed to be kept, to violate his constitutional rights. But the reality is, in doing so, this guy could be guilty as hell, but he could get off because of what they did. And that's absurd.
Right. And as somebody who, you know, presumably cares about the victim and cares about getting what you believe is the right outcome to this, it's one thing to not get a conviction because there's no body, you don't have forensic evidence, but it's another thing to not get a conviction because you were shady.
You fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. Because there's a strong possibility that he did do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if any of that is true from the third confession letter, then he's a monster for what he did.
Yeah.
I don't take child abuse very well. And, you know, luckily we didn't record me having breakdowns about this, but like what he wrote in that letter was horrible.
Yeah. And so just as a quick side note, I did have Ethan read the third letter in which the prosecution's case is mainly based while we are not recording, just so he could kind of have context. And because, again, I did leave parts out of the show, but I thought it was important for him to just have all of that information. And yeah, it's
absolutely awful. Yeah. And like I said, if even a third of that is true, then Corey is an absolute monster. And the fact that it's even a possibility that he could get off because of the mistakes the cops made over violating basic civil rights, basic constitutional rights, is ridiculous.
Yeah. And, you know, so it makes sense that this is what the defense is pushing, right? So they called up Lieutenant Colonel William Anderson, the assistant superintendent for Hampton Roads Regional Jail, to testify about Corey's experience in jail. He stated that Corey was transferred several times between a COVID quarantine unit, because remember, he was initially incarcerated in January of 2022.
Right.
And so he went between their general population and what they called acute watch, which was suicide watch.
Yeah.
Exactly. Lieutenant Colonel Anderson testified that Corey was put on acute watch several times over the course of his incarceration. Corey also refused to eat and lost 60 pounds while in custody. And for those of you who don't know what Corey Bigsby looks like, he was not a large man to begin with. I mean, he wasn't tiny or anything, but I mean, 60 pounds was an incredibly significant amount of weight for him to lose.
Mm-hmm. None of this behavior proves innocence or guilt.
No, but it, again, with the defense trying to prove that these confessions shouldn't be taken seriously because of Corey's mental illness, this does speak to that because he was clearly going through a lot. I mean, several suicide watches, you know, refusing to eat, all of that combined with the initial interrogation, it all bolsters that idea.
Sure. Or the prosecution could spin it as this was all him being overridden by guilt.
Yeah.
Based on what he did.
Now, the defense, in addition to just hoping the jury would disregard the confession letters, also hoped to prove that Cody was alive after June 18th, 2021. As Curtis Brown said in his opening statement, if they could prove that Cody was alive after this date, then that undermines the Commonwealth's entire case and the jury couldn't convict his client.
Okay, so what's the proof?
Well, the defense called Corey's sister, Tondalea Butler, to the stand. She had supported her brother's innocence from the beginning and continued to do so through her testimony. She said that she saw her nephew in September 2021 at her home in D.C., and that this visit took place 3 months after the prosecution says that Corey killed his son.
Is there anybody else that can corroborate that? Because, I mean, she obviously has a vested interest in him staying out of jail, being that it's her brother.
Yeah, it doesn't appear as though the defense brought on corroborating witnesses. During cross-examination, the prosecution actually played several news reports in which she gave different answers about the last time she had seen Cody. Because when I said that she had been on her brother's side since the beginning, like, I have seen her, I mean, since the beginning, talking to reporters about how her brother would never hurt any of his children. He was such a good dad, et cetera, et cetera. But so they showed several interviews where she gave different stories. However, the last interview that she did in June 2023, she does give that September 2021 date. Now, interesting, this is also right around the time that Corey was released on bail.
Mm-hmm.
Just throwing that out there.
Well, let's also throw out that, you know, she's saying he was such a good dad, but he left his four kids under the age of six for several hours to go buy a car.
Well, if you believe the prosecution's theory of the case, he only left three of his kids under the age of six alone. Tondalea also testified that Dina Kareem had been untruthful when she testified that she didn't really know anyone in Corey's family and was unable to reach them. According to her, she's known Dina since they were both kids. And now I do want to make it clear, because I feel like I might have made that a little bit confusing. Tondalea was not in the courtroom during Dina's testimony because, you know, when you're a witness, you're not allowed to be in the courtroom. So the lawyer asked her about her relationship with Dina. And she's like, yeah, we've known each other since she was kids. And so the defense is like, okay, well, why would she say that she wouldn't be able to get a hold of you? And that's why she couldn't see her children. And, you know, so Tondalea's like, yeah, no, like, we've known each other. She could definitely get a hold of me. And the point of this is to discredit Dina and to basically throw all of her testimony into question.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not the important point that Dina made in her testimony. You know, the important point was, like, the email and that
not being allowed to see her kids,
right? But if they can show that she wasn't being honest about one part, then maybe she's not being honest about other parts as well. While that may have scored the defense some points, their next witness really didn't. They called a man who had claimed to have seen Cody at a grocery store in January 2022, just 2 days before he was reported missing. However, during cross-examination, the prosecution showed him a photo and asked if the child in the picture was the one he had seen. The man replied, quote, "It sure looks like him," end quote.
And was it the older brother?
It was the older brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, did this man see all four of the kids, or did he just see one kid?
He might have just seen one kid. And, right. And you know, and then he did kind of correct himself before the prosecution reveals that it was not Cody and said, well, I don't know. The picture seems a little off, but I mean, the damage was done, you know?
Right. It calls into question whether he actually saw Cody or Cody's older brother.
Right. Another way in which the defense attempted to prove that Corey's confessions were false was to try to prove that some of the facts of the confession had been suggested by detectives. And so now we're getting into coerced confessions.
Right.
Which is, you know, we've seen a ton, right?
Yeah, in absolutely.
Overturned convictions. Yep. You know, you go back and you see that these false confessions come from detectives, you know, basically implanting the ideas into the defendant's head.
Which is, not to get too technical with police issues or whatever, but that's one of the main issues with the Reed interrogation method, is that it essentially implants, like you said, it implants stories or quote unquote facts into the line of questioning.
Yeah. And another big, and I don't know if this is part of the Reed technique or not. Another big one that we see in these a lot is hypothetically.
Yeah.
If you were to have commit this crime, how would you have done it? How would you have
done it? Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the person goes on from there, and then that hypothetical turns into a confession.
Right.
Yeah. So they called two witnesses, the defense, up to the stand. The first was NCIS agent Daniel Smith. He testified that during his interview with Corey Bigsby, he suggested twice that Cody fell down the stairs, a version of events that appeared in Corey's August 5th, 2022 confession. The final witness that the defense called was a Hampton Roads detective who also interviewed Corey. Video of the interrogation was played, in which the detective suggested several times that Cody may have died due to an accident. In the tape, Corey denies this, but this version of events later shows up in three of his four confessions.
Right. So that is maybe not the direct saying he fell down the stairs.
Yeah.
But the mention of it potentially being a mistake is definitely a Reed technique. That is you're basically convincing the suspect that what they did or what happened was okay, in air quotes, okay. It's not that bad. It was an accident. Oh yeah. Like, I understand. All you have to do is just tell me what happened, and, like, you know, we'll get this sorted out. It's like trying to buddy buddy up to them,
right,
in a way, and giving, like, them out.
Yeah. And in cases where it's like a spouse killing, it's like, oh yeah, you know, rods.
Like, yeah, no, 100%. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's giving them an option for an easy way out of, or for, like, a conversational easy way out, you know?
Right.
Like, oh yeah, I understand. I understand why you would do that. Yeah, like, you know, I've got kids. Kids drive me nuts too. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. saying shit like that is the Reed methodology. And that's, again, why it leads to false confessions, especially if you're dealing with somebody that has either mental health issues or is
developmentally disabled.
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, they don't know what's actually happening.
Right.
So.
And there's a desire to please oftentimes.
Right. It's not great. It's not a great method.
Yeah, for sure. Again, I mentioned earlier, we've had a lot of new listeners lately. I know about the Reed technique because of my lifelong obsession with true crime. Ethan, why do you know about the Reed technique? Because you are not a true crime person?
No, I'm in law enforcement, although I am not an investigator. I'm not a criminal investigator. However, I have taken a lot of trainings on the Reed technique and the problems with it. And I've taken a lot of trainings on other methods of interrogation.
So with these two witnesses further casting doubts on the confessions, the defense rested its case without putting Corey Bigsby on the stand.
Probably a smart move on their part.
Yes.
Because
I cannot imagine that would have gone well.
I'm not a proponent of the defense here, so please don't hate me for this, but, like, good Lord,
he would have probably gotten destroyed in Cross.
Yeah, for sure. And just, again, to put the timeline of this into context, we are recording this the night before we're putting this out. Like, it is currently Wednesday, March 13th. This trial began last Monday with jury selection. The prosecution put on their witnesses from, like, Wednesday afternoon to the end of the day Friday. The defense presented their case on Monday, and that was it. Jurors were back in the courtroom at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, March 12th, which is literally yesterday as we're recording this. They were given deliberation instructions and then closing arguments commenced. Commonwealth attorney Antoine Bell reiterated his statements that he had made in his opening argument, in which he called Corey Bixby a predator.
Now, remind me again why he's being called a predator.
So in his closing statements, he said something to the effect of, imagine a loving parent. This is not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a predator who systematically abused his son and then murdered him.
Okay. It's closing argument, so they're supposed to be flamboyant. But
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
He went on to say that Bixby, quote, beat that child with his fists and dumped the child like he was trash, end quote. Bell urged the jurors to use their common sense and said that they had the ability to bring Cody what no one else could bring, accountability. Curtis Brown gave the closing remarks for the defense. He took longer than Bell and really tried to hammer home the idea of reasonable doubt. This is obviously a strategy that makes sense, as no-body homicide cases are notoriously difficult to prove for this very reason. There's a lot of potential reasonable doubt. In fact, this case is only the fourth such case in Hampton Roads history. Though these difficulties prevent a lot of no-body cases from being prosecuted, when they do make it to court, they actually have a higher conviction rate than standard murder cases. According to A&E, there have been around 500 no-body murder trials in the U.S. The conviction rate on these is around 86%, as opposed to around 70% when there is a body. But Curtis Brown was trying to beat those odds, telling the jury, quote, reasonable doubt means not guilty, end quote. After all, despite Corey providing a building number and directions to where he said he buried Cody's body, investigators weren't able to find anything at that location or any other locations that were investigated.
Right.
There are no fingerprints, no DNA, no other forensics that show that Cody Bixby was murdered at all, much less by his father.
Right. No partially burned clothing. No dumpster fires at hospitals.
Yeah, no suspiciously cleaned up spaces in the home.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing.
I wonder what the significance of that building has for Corey, though.
Yeah, I'm actually really curious about that as well, and I do not know.
Because, I mean, he mentioned it in all four of his confessions, correct?
Yeah, every single one. I mean,
that is very specific to that, which, you know, would lend some credence to these confessions being real. But if they didn't find anything there, it makes me wonder what the significance of that building is to him, which may have nothing to do with this case at all. Just curiosity.
Well, and another thing that I'm curious about is obviously the apartment where they were living was searched many times. I mean, including right after he called 911 and reported his son missing, right? What I don't know and what I haven't seen and I hope has happened is that police searched the home that Corey bought just prior to him reporting Cody missing. So we talk about this in our very first episode on this case. Even though Corey and the children were apparently living in this apartment in Hampton Roads, and, you know, all of their stuff was there, again, like the clutter, you know, like their stuff was there, right? Corey had bought and closed on a home just weeks before he reported his son missing. So he had access to that home for at least 2 weeks prior to this 911 call. but I don't know if it was ever searched, if the yard was searched, if any part of it was searched, because it doesn't appear that he was living there, but he owned it and he had access to it.
And it wasn't new construction.
No, I don't think it was.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, but you know,
regardless, yeah.
If the prosecution's theory of the case is true, and Cody did die on or around June 18th, he didn't have access to the house then. He did not own the house then. However, let's just say, and again, this is pure wild speculation, what if that building in Maryland was
the primary dump site and then he had been moved?
Yeah. So again, pure speculation. I don't know. I've never read anything about whether or not the new home was searched. But of course, there's just so much that we don't know about the police investigation in this.
Right. And they're not going to release any of that.
No. I mean, eventually, now that the case is over, you know, we could perhaps get some of that information. But obviously, up to this point of us recording this,
none of that was going to be
released to the public.
We would also hope that they would, at the very least, go and visit the mom's house in D.C. also.
Right. And yeah, I don't know for sure if they did that as well. Brown also told the jurors, quote, "Not one soul saw my client do anything," end quote. And he's not wrong. I mean, as damning as Corey's brother's testimony was, he didn't testify that he saw his father.
But that was pretty heavy.
Yeah. He concluded by saying, quote, "This is not a case about sympathy, but what the facts say. You got no body, you got no death," end quote. During the Commonwealth's rebuttal, Antoine Bell told the jurors, quote, "Cody's eyes were open when his brother found him. So the last image he saw was his dad beating him," end quote. After both sides wrapped up their closing arguments, jurors were sent to deliberate and ultimately to decide Corey Bigsby's fate. They headed back to the jury room at 11:25 a.m., just over 2 hours later, at 1:45 p.m., the jurors were back with their verdict. Corey Bigsby was found guilty of the murder of Cody Bigsby and of hiding the little boy's body. Corey, who showed little emotion throughout the week and a half-long trial, remained stoic as the verdict was read. He was then led away in handcuffs. Corey Bigsby is scheduled to be sentenced on June 18th, 2024. Which, according to the prosecution's theory of the case, is the third anniversary of Cody Bigsby's death. Corey Bigsby is facing 40 years for the second-degree murder conviction and 5 years for concealing Cody's body. He still has to face his original charges of child neglect.
And I'm assuming defense is going to appeal the decision.
Yeah.
I guess it's too new. Nothing's been filed yet.
Yeah, nothing's been filed yet because this literally happened
yesterday,
36 hours ago.
Yeah.
But in the interviews outside of the courtroom, Bigsby's attorney was obviously very upset with the verdict and with how the Commonwealth tried the case. For his part, Antoine Bell told reporters that he will recommend the maximum 45-year sentence with no leniency, even if Corey gives information that does lead them to Cody's body. To your point earlier of it being good that they didn't have Corey take the stand, Antoine spoke to that and said he was ready. Like, he was going to rip him apart if he was given the opportunity.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. He admits, though, that this is a case in which true justice and closure simply is impossible, as they're likely to never know where Cody's body is.
I mean, the only thing that I would say is if any of that confession is true, his third confession, then this fucker deserves to go away. And I don't like to take sides in cases like this, even if it's been vetted in the court. But reading that was horrible. And if any of that is true, then I hope he rots in jail.
To those who loved Cody and to the Hampton Roads community who took him in as their own, they can all rest a little easier knowing that they received what the Commonwealth of Virginia promised them: accountability. can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!